Track This Thread, Chapter 3. Clint wakes up because he gets that preternatural tingle, that dread crawling like ice down his spine, that can only mean one thing. There are maybe 10 people in the world whose presence won't wake Clint up. And of that group, only one of them makes Clint's dick try to shrivel up back inside his body as a reflex response. He pulls a pillow over his face and asks, "What do you want, Natasha?" She pulls the pillow off his face. "You're lucky that when I found you in bed with a teenager, her first reaction was to tell me that you were too old and gross to bone." Clint is obscurely hurt by that, because it's not like this is the first time Kate has expressed something to that effect. But still, that's mean. Clint's okay. He can get girls to let him touch their boobs. And with guys, he does pretty good. For some definition of pretty good, anyway. One time, Colson had walked into Clint's apartment and found some high-gloss second-year medical resident named Misha slumming it, doing a line of coke off Clint's shield-issued tablet computer in the kitchen. All Colson had done was stare blankly at Clint as he'd hopped around in ratty boxers looking for pants and some dignity. Unhelpfully, Misha had taken one look at Colson, another look at Clint, and turned back to Colson to say, he was saying your name the whole time? "Your effort is appreciated, Mr. Carmichael," Colson had said to the guy, which was the first Clint had heard of Misha's last name. And turning back to where Clint was fighting a losing battle with a She-Ra t-shirt, Colson had added, "And get your ass moving before pickup leaves you here, Barton," and left. Now, Clint just stays prone in the ruin of his bed while Natasha frowns at him. Katie Kate's like a child and a Hawkeye. It doesn't count. "She's wearing your clothes," Natasha says. "Or clothes that became yours after you stole them." Clint squints at her. "Are those your Riot Girl sweatpants?" "Worryingly, no," Natasha says, and reaches down to poke menacingly around the soft tissues of his throat with her deadly fingers. "Get up. Your child Hawkeye is making coffee, and you've been instructed to present yourself for daily check-in." "You're shitting me," Clint groans, rolling himself up in the blankets like this burrito of sheets will protect him from Shield invasive brand of bullshit. "They cleared me!" At this point, Natasha busts out her nails, clawing the flat sheets and the blankets away from him with ruthless efficiency. "This is basically just standard report. They just want to see you in person because of obvious reasons." Not that it makes anything better, given that standard report is only the single most hated SHIELD policy. There's nothing an organization of highly mission-driven personalities trained to operate successfully with little to no backup likes better than having to call in once a day just to let everyone know they haven't defected to an enemy state yet so far today. It's like taking angry, belligerent attendance. "They probably want to stab me some more," Clint grumbles, but he hears the hiss of coffee in the next room and the happy clinks of Lucy's tags, the low murmur of a voice through the wall. This is what mornings are probably supposed to sound like for normal people with normal lives, with normal people sharing their spaces and all the hours of their days. Natasha ruins the moment by throwing a pair of jeans in his face. Kate and Natasha do some psychic lady posturing over coffee. Clint doesn't know the details because penis, but he can tell they're sizing each other up, which involves a lot of looking at each other's boobs in a clinical, unexciting way. He doesn't even want to know. They're each sipping coffee angrily at each other with one of the two mugs Clint owns, so he's drinking out of the pot, again, and hoping neither of them zero their angry looks in on him, some more. "Clint calls you Hawkeye too," Natasha starts, voice uninflected. Clint puts down the coffee pot and covers his face with his hands. Oh, God, Natasha! Kate narrows her eyes. I shoot, okay? You like the glory? Feeling like a hero? Natasha continues. Too casual. Like she doesn't have an inch-thick dossier on Catherine, whatever nutty family middle name she's rocking, Bishop. Recent graduate of probably a fancy private school. Future student of a crazy brick and weed-covered college, who got real good with a bow and arrow. Clint doesn't know any of the fine print details of Katie Kate. He knows the important stuff. That she took a hit and got up from it fucking furious. That she didn't realize she wasn't fitting in until it was too late to change anything. He puts up with her being on S.H.I.E.L.D.'s radar because he's the person who gets to track her on it. I like being able to help people. Period. Kate snaps. I don't like being helpless. Natasha lets this go without further comment, glancing down at her watch and back up at Clint to say, Come on, we're going to be late. And then they're on the street, in the sudden cold autumn air, all the buildings shivering around them in the early gray morning light, watery gray. You okay that she's apparently just going to hang around your apartment like that? Natasha asks, when Clint climbs into the passenger seat of the S.H.I.E.L.D. issue SUV. Clint shrugs. Nothing worth stealing, he says. And as Natasha puts the car into drive, because Clint is a dumbass, he blurts out, Hey, do you know anybody at S.H.I.E.L.D. called Pam? Natasha doesn't know anybody named Pam. She makes him check with Sitwell, who has dark, bruised smudges under his eyes. He says, Barton, good to have you back with us. And he sounds like he means it. Sitwell looks horrible, wrung out. The entire time Clint's worked with S.H.I.E.L.D., the only person with fewer expressions than Coulson had been Sitwell, and it had probably made up the foundation levels of their inscrutable, diner-based friendship. Clint thinks that if this were a normal workplace, they'd talk about it, maybe put up some pictures, have some sort of remembrance ceremony. There's these massive ad hoc memorials flung up all over Midtown these days. Flowers and electric candles, office supply offerings littering the entranceways and public floors of glass and steel buildings, still showing their bones, still under repair. But S.H.I.E.L.D. is used to losing people, and S.H.I.E.L.D. agents are, by proxy, supposed to be used to losing each other. And even though this was death on a catastrophic, mind-bending scale, everyone is still trying to operate as situation normal. Clint's got no gauge of normal, healthy responses, but he knows this isn't it. S.H.I.E.L.D.'s still huge with silences. All the halls normally overflowing with people, whittled down to a skeleton crew. Clint doesn't know if that's all the people who are left, or if Fury and Hill have deployed personnel to other places in desperate need of resources. If the destabling event of the Battle of New York had spread the network ever thinner. But maybe there should be a memorial. Maybe there should be flowers and electric candles. And maybe Clint wants to leave a ceremonial offering of binder clips for Perry in HR, who's never going to cry about Assistant Number 2's name again, and buy from public information. Maybe people need that. Maybe they should do that here. Out loud, Clint says, Glad to be back, sir. Because the alternative was being dead or still murdering people under Loki's direction. Sitwell smirks at him. Oh, I'm sure. You and Romanov are wanted down in the third-level briefing room. And he holds up a hand against Natasha's protests. Nothing breaking, just some developing situations we'd like you to have preliminary intel on. So they go, down the steps into SL3, where they take the long way and admire the cavern of the Second Avenue line being dug, visible through a massive concealed window someone had frivolously, charmingly commissioned when they'd shut down SL 4, 5, and fittingly 6. The experience of playing Hill's security attachment when she'd been trapped in a series of torturously redacted meetings with John Loda and Mike Bloomberg had been pretty phenomenal. The sit-rep is agonizingly normal. It's some mealy-faced recruit giving the rundown with appropriate slide accompaniment of some potential flare-ups. They're all standard and currently low stakes enough that it's unlikely ever to wend its way up the ladder of escalating shit shows to qualify for SHIELD attention. Everything they pick up from government work is a catastrophe already in progress. Most of the missions they initiate aren't any better, to be honest. One time, Clint and Natasha had gone on a milk run that started in a North Korean prison camp. They're in the cluster of impromptu market stalls, built in the shadow of the Grand Central work zone, buying coffee and banana pudding from the Magnolia Bakery. "No lid, just put a spoon in it," Clint tells them, making grabby hands. When Stark calls. "God, what do you want?" Natasha asks, which is how Clint knows it's Stark.
"Nice. That's real nice, Natalie Rushman, you lying liar who lies and spies,"
Clint can hear Tony say, tinny and argumentative coming out of Nat's phone. Her face is a vision of long-suffering disinterest. Clint still has the 300-plus angry texts she'd sent him during her cover with Stark Industries as Pepper's assistant. They're a fantastic mix of, "This is fucking bullshit. Why am I doing all of this? These fucking draconian shoes." And Russian threats to punch fuck Stark with a rusty crossbeam. "If you're going to call to gossip, I have better things to do," Nat lies. Currently, she's fighting Clint for a banana pudding spoon. Tony says something in reply, and the only bit of it Clint manages to hear is bus monitor. Clint, for obvious reasons, missed a bunch of stuff immediately after the Battle of New York. But early in September, Stark had called and given probably the most deranged, rambling monologue Clint's ever heard outside of a supervillain lair, and concluded with,
"Anyway, the point is, I'm calling to see if Fury would let you and Natasha come out to play, because Stars and Stripes here..." "Fucking ow, Rogers!"
What Steve wanted was to show them a letter he'd gotten, that he'd read like all the thousands and thousands of others, to lay the crinkled paper in Clint's shaking hands and ask, "You and Agent Romanoff knew him best. Did you know about this?" And Clint had only managed to read so far as the line, "My name is David Lazinski. I'm writing to you about my friend Phil Coulson," before he'd felt like someone had landed a punch directly in the solar plexus, suddenly breathless. All in all, Clint remembers too much about that day in Arlington. He kept his sunglasses on the entire time and wore his nicest suit. He'd put on one of the three ties that Coulson had knotted up for him and that Clint kept loosened enough to slip over his head and hanging on his bathroom doorknob in Bed-Stuy. It had felt like a lodestone around his neck the entire time, watching Sitwell and Fury put fucking Captain America merch around Coulson's grave, watching Skolimowski put down a clutch of blushing pink peonies. Clint remembers stupidly, vividly, running his fingers in the groove of the Latin Christian cross on the cool stone of Coulson's grave marker. He remembers thinking about Coulson saying, "Ish," when Clint had asked, perched high in the clerestory of a Gothic cathedral with a scope lasered in on some bad guy or another, if he was religious. Clint remembers the way all of those strangers, Coulson's friends, had introduced themselves, laughed self-depreciatingly, because they understood it was sort of a nerdy hobby. It wasn't that weird Coulson wouldn't have told his co-workers. Clint remembers trying to read a letter to Coulson out loud, when it was his turn during the impromptu memorial. The way his tongue had gone useless over the name Phil, and how Banner had taken the letter away and carried on. And it's fucking dumb to be sick about this, to be hurt like this still. But Clint's been called a dumbass by good and bad and wrong and right people his entire life. He's a dumbass, and he can't stop thinking about it. Can't stop being sick about it. It's why he's forced himself to read 7 years worth of Captain America fanboy bullshit and learn more about the interpersonal politics of the Howling Commandos HQ than any human being other than a Howling Commando needs to know. This was part of Coulson's life. This stupid website and its dumb digital people had filled all those empty spaces, those trailed-off sentences about some new History Channel documentary Coulson had started and never bothered to finish. That 2 days he disappeared every time Comic-Con was in town. Clint's always been a greedy fuck. Would have hoarded all of Coulson's details like treasure and sat on top like an angry dragon if he could. And this was something Clint hadn't known at all. Some huge secret that was so big and pervasive he'd overlooked it. Missed how it was baked into the margins of every single conversation and interaction. Clint keeps trying to see if that changes anything. Alters the foundational embarrassment of his, what did Xavier call it? An undisclosed admiration? It doesn't. It just makes his stomach churn, something in his gut ache from looking at restaurant menus and into the windows of grocery stores. Those things on the other side aren't his to have, and neither were Coulson's secrets. But that doesn't make Clint any less hungry. He would have probably, okay, definitely, made fun of Coulson, but at least he would have known. He would have been able to poke Coulson in the shoulder, and then Clint could have hooked his chin over Coulson's shoulder and asked snotty questions. What's this forum? Are you its dead mother? Who are these assholes? Why didn't you tell me about it? Has Rogers seen this? Have you figured out yet that I've decided to keep that vigilante that was running around shooting gray rapists in the face as a kind of angry apprentice? Who is Pam? Will you kiss me? Can I keep you? Do you want to meet my dog? Could you love me if I tried really hard? First things first, Stark says, when the elevator doors open out into the common room. Credit where credit's due. I wouldn't have figured this out at all if Robin of Loxley wasn't using Jarvis to creep on people. Roger, Banner, and Natasha all stare at Clint. Clint's reflective responses all involve yelling, "Fuck all you assholes!" and leaving. So he ignores them and glares at Stark until Tony waves something imaginary away with his hand and adds, "Anyway, I called this meeting to discuss..." He snaps his fingers and an image pops up behind him. Howling Commandos HQ stretched out until it's the length of the common room windows. This hot bottled mess of nerd sweat and patriotism. "Pepper says it's mostly a historical enthusiast website," Roger says feebly. "Okay, sure. Because whacking it to historical enthusiasm is better," Stark allows generously, and Rogers covers his face delicately with one massive hand. "Anyway, back on point. We have an issue." Tony glances at the ceiling. "Jarvis, if you will." Overhead, Jarvis chimes in with, "A pleasure, sir." And Clint's ass twitches at how fucking unsettling it is to be reminded that, A, Stark's building can hold hours-long conversations with people. B, Stark's building is about to hold an hours-long conversation with Clint. And C, Stark's building has definitely watched Clint take a dump. Which implies a greater degree of intimacy than Clint's reached in his handful. Okay, two real relationships. When Agent Barton requested I compile a database of all of Agent Coulson's posts to the Howling Commandos HQ, I did so using 24 different search criteria, Jarvis tells them, drawing up and discarding various informational screens and algorithmic data as he goes. Limiting collection to his official login comments turned out to be inadequate, as on occasion he posted either anonymously from a public computer terminal and signed off as PC, or did not identify himself at all. Stark says, basically, I think he was trolling his own forum. He was diffusing potential arguments in the most politic way possible, Jarvis corrects. As I have already explained to Sir several times. Tony mouths, trolling. Clint digs his nails into the meaty part of his palm, and Natasha asks, is there a point to this, Stark? It turned out the most efficient method of collecting Agent Coulson's posts were by doing a thorough analysis of his writing style and running forum posts through to determine which matched, Jarvis carries on. As you may have discovered by now, Agent Barton, this method picked up some unexpected comments. His mouth goes dry. Yeah. Clint rubs a hand over his face so he doesn't have to look at the way Bruce's face is soft and sympathetic. Stuff from some guy named Bus Monitor. 10 points to Hufflepuff, Stark says, looking manic. Now, originally I thought that Jarvis had failed me and that I would have to go crazy stage parenting on him and hard code a new algorithm to fulfill your creepy masturbatory agent and cap needs. Clint gives Steve his best, most convincing, pleading look. Totally not like that. Steve's expression conveys that Clint's best, most convincing, pleading look is not convincing. Except then I realized Jarvis was right, Tony concludes with a flourish.
I usually am, sir,
Jarvis interjects, arch. Not in front of company, dear, Stark reposts, automatic, and pulls up another screen. And Clint sees Bus Monitor posts scrolling next to ones from PC. Pieces of the text highlight, superimpose one another, as Tony talks. And Clint can see the way the words overlap, that the cadence is a little too familiar, as Tony says, these guys are way too fucking similar for this to be an accident. Tell me you guys are seeing this. Clint does. He really does. Because the next page is Bus Monitor saying, I could fight you over this all day. I've already laid in a supply of Little Debbie. And if Clint Barton were any sort of delicate flower, he'd faint or falter. But he's had it sometimes literally beaten out of him. And all Clint does is get pissed. Clint thinks that one time, Coulson did love him. He goes over that moment at night sometimes. The way he presses his thumbs down on green and purple bruises, is forever running his tongue over the cuts inside his mouth after one bullshit brawl or another. It hurts. It fucking hurts. But he thinks about it with the religious fervor of the converted. This is his tent in Middle America. This is that sermon he can't stop hearing echo inside his head. It had been late-ish, night sweeping over Varanasi, and all the lights of Diwali scraping back against it, gleaming in the orange burnt of tempered darkness. Clint remembers the sudden drop in the temperature, the way it had been a steady 85 degrees all goddamn day, and how the heat had vanished like the continental shelf underfoot. And the chill had seeped in where it could, between the huddled gush of people around the banks of the Ganges, lanterns floating in the water in between the golden slivers of light. Clint remembers so perfectly the steps down to the water, the thousands of candles lit in perfect ordered rows down them, the fireworks, the lights strung up everywhere, and how he'd felt like the entire city was gilded, golden. The next part's not clear. The next bit, Clint's not sure about, because it feels like he was swimming in honey when he saw it. All the noises gone wobbly underwater. But he thinks he turned and saw, for too long, for eons, a year, maybe 15 eternal seconds. Coulson looking at him like people look at women in black and white movies. Like Clint had looked at the orange-warm windows of houses in suburban neighborhoods, miles away from the cold dirt of the circus tents. Backlit against the corona of lights gone up, Coulson's eyes had been dark and darkly sweet. And anybody else, Clint's automatic bodily responses would have moved his legs and hands, and he would have pressed his palm to the line of Coulson's jaw and drawn him in. Coulson was a man who was ruthlessly kind, whose fury and forgiveness came at once. Over the years, he'd let Clint sleep in his office, take his stuff, steal his clothes, occupy his time with complete disregard for how every incursion he didn't fight was getting Clint a little deeper. And he'd done it with that fucking look. Patient, unhurried, like he would be there still waiting when Clint was ready to come in from the cold. So Clint can feel the horrible swoop of his stomach, the disbelief that makes his throat hurt. Coulson wouldn't do this. He wouldn't be this cruel. Because even if it was only that once, for that accidental, infinite moment by the river while 1 million lights had been scraping away at the darkness, it had been real to Clint. And to let them, fuck it, to let him grieve like this is too awful. And the hope for what this might mean goes down like a coal in Clint's belly, so that the harder he clutches at it, the worse it hurts.